And while our recovery since 2009, the slow crawl back up out of the hole, has certainly taken a lot longer than historically is normal. Employment is at 5.8, unemployment rather is at 5.8%, which is higher than is historically normal.
Well, it depends on the historic period.
Well, through the averages over the many years it's been measured, this is a bit high. But the Federal Reserve is out there with a stimulative, it's called, economic environment that they're creating. In other words, when they have retained their interest rates at the Federal Reserve near zero, which means banks can effectively borrow money, although they rarely do, from the Federal Reserve at effectively 0% interest.
Right.
Now,
can we explain why they would do that?
So they could loan it to somebody at a higher interest
rate.
Right.
There's a couple of reasons why they would do that. There's that. They can turn around and loan the money. They've just gotten it from the Federal Reserve. But the Federal Reserve does these loans on a very short-term basis. So they could change their mind and say, I want that money back pretty quick. They really do it because if a bank... The reason why bank hours are the way they are, usually a bank has, traditionally it's closed at 4 o'clock, is because they have reserve requirements. They have to have a certain amount of basically cash, but technically speaking, money on hand in
cash
the bank.
Like AAA rated something.
Right. At the end of the day, so that the Federal Reserve and the FDIC don't think that they're insolvent, so that if you show up the next day and you want some money, they have it to give you.
Yeah, you want to stay out of solvent.
And the reason why bank hours have been to 4 p.m. so often, or 3 p.m. in some places, is because their loan officers are making loans during the day, and traditionally there aren't computers, they're just abacuses and pencils. And you calculate, all right, how many loans were given out today? Oh, we loaned out too much money. Well, they have from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock to contact another bank or the Federal Reserve, which is another bank, and get a spot loan, a loan for a short-term period to cover their reserves. So when the Federal Reserve has an interest rate of zero, those loans are free, basically. They're almost free. Where the Federal Reserve gives them a loan to meet their reserves as long as they're solvent. The problem is that people aren't giving out the loans at high length high numbers, so they don't really need to go to the Federal Reserve very often, which is... Anyway, go ahead.
That's
the background.
In light of the fact that we are approaching normal, whatever that means, the Federal Reserve's stimulative 0% interest rate, which, by the way, sort of sets the signal for interest rates across the board, is probably going to be revised in the not very far distant future. So the question is, when is the Federal Reserve going to return interest rates to a more normal level? And the consensus is and has been around June of next year. Now,
summer.
Earlier it was later.
Yeah.
So what's happening
Let's say that again. Earlier, it was later.
Earlier, the consensus was that it would happen later, like October.
Okay.
But it's
I
been
just
moving.
Like the statement earlier is later.
Earlier, it was later.
Earlier speaking, they thought it would be later before the... Okay, gotcha. Okay.
Earlier speaking?
Speaking earlier, they said it would be later. But now, speaking today, they say it'll be earlier.
Actually, it was speaking yesterday.
Okay.
But I'm not sure they were speaking, they were writing.
Okay, so they're saying June.
No, they were writing June.
I'm thinking June, and I've been
thinking you were saying,
June for a long
saying,
time. I'm also saying June.
But it was writing, because I didn't actually hear them. I just read it.
All right, good. Okay.
Trying to be very compliant.
Yeah, everybody listening is going, they're crazy, and we're going, yes, we are.
Yes. Anyway, the whole issue is that the tea leaves are being read, and the great speculation is on when the Federal Reserve will start to raise interest rates, and that estimate is starting to move closer in time. It was in August. It was in October. Then it moved to August. Now it's at June of next year. So sometime, probably in the first half of next year, we're finally going to see interest rates at the Federal Reserve come off zero, and we're actually seeing in the 2-year Treasury bond, we're beginning to see some increases in interest rates. Now, this has been long awaited, and you say, well, what is the significance about that?
Why is that even a big deal?
It means our mortgage interest rates will go up. It means that that any variable interest rates you have on anything are likely to rise thereafter. It means it's going to be a little harder to get a loan. There's a whole series of things that occur, and it all has to do with the fact that the Federal Reserve is, instead of assisting the economy in its growth, is very likely to go back to slowing it down just a bit.
Right.
Now, do I think that they're going to raise interest rates quite a lot? No. First, there is very little pressure to increase wages and start an inflationary cycle, which is why one of the reasons they raise interest rates is to head that off. Secondly, the world economy is still very, very, very fragile.
Yep.
The Europeans keep talking about starting quantitative easing because they are slipping into recession. They actually had a negative jobs growth. I love
negative
those.
Negative growth is when you grow backwards.
Yes. Right. In other words, they had more jobs lost last month in the Eurozone than were gained.
Have you had any negative growth? I realize that you're getting into your mid-60s.
Yes, I have. I'm no longer as tall as I used to be.
So you are retracting.
Yes. I'm issuing a major retraction here. But in the Eurozone, their economy is fragile, to say the least. The central bank doesn't, according to many people, have the authority to launch the equivalent of quantitative easing. So they keep talking about it, but they haven't done it. And I think one of the reasons that they haven't done it is because there's a lot of people who would take action against the federal, against the European Central Bank if they started trying to stimulate the economies of the southern countries in the Eurozone. In other words, Europe is not out of the woods yet. And Russia, for whatever it's worth, is slipping downhill at an accelerating rate. Their economy is sliding and sliding steadily faster. Very minor point in some ways, but a very major point in another, is that India just officially signed and agreed to a contract to buy several billion dollars worth of helicopters from Sikorsky, now, which is a U.S. company. Now, say, well, big deal. So that's just another example. No, it is a big deal because India is the largest democracy on the planet.
As far as people.
Right.
Yeah.
It and China are growth examples of emerging countries that are growing very quickly and have very large economies. India traditionally has bought their major technology purchases, like computers and major computers, power plants, aircraft, tanks, the whole thing, from Russia. And they earlier signed a contract with Boeing, and now they're signing a contract with Sikorsky. This is a major shift in what's going on in the big wide world, because that is billions of dollars that doesn't go to Russia, but instead comes out of India and goes to the United States. These little signs around the world, and there's just many more of them.
What's the size of the contract for the helicopters?
Is
it in the billions?
It's in the billions.
Okay. I'm saying this for a reason, because the GDP of India and the GDP of Russia are roughly equivalent. India is a little bit...
Oh, it's 1 billion.
Okay, so 1 billion.
It's not a huge number by itself. It's just very significant.
Let's put it in perspective.
They didn't buy hip helicopters from Russia. They
right.
bought Sikorsky helicopters.
All right, so $1 billion. You say mm-hmm. it's not a lot of money. Well, it's more than I have, but let's say the GDP numbers for India. India's GDP is 1.88 trillion dollars. That's all of everything that's made in India put together, minus anything that they're exporting, importing, all that good stuff. It comes back to say India's growth in its economy, or its just ongoing income and creation ability, is about 1,800 billions.
Mm-hmm.
They get tax revenue, which is a small percentage of that. And they're using $1 billion. When you're talking about the United States, it's not a lot of money. When you're talking about India, it's a huge amount of money. And Russia's economy is slightly smaller than India's economy. Russia's economy, I guess it's slightly bigger. It's $2 trillion. So that $1 billion that is going away from Russia and to the United States doesn't have a big impact on us. But Russia's economy is already hurting, and this $2 trillion number is from 2013, and what's happening this year is their GDP is going backwards. It's shrinking at close to double-digit numbers, which means that they have less money coming in, less things being created, less oil being purchased per dollar, or more oil per dollar, just less dollars coming in.
Less dollars coming in from oil.
So their economy is quite possibly going to be overtaken by India in the coming year.
Mm-hmm.
And India is, instead of giving money to Russia at this point, turning and giving it to us. So this is a dangerous situation for Russia. They don't like it very much.
Interesting little point. You know, the United States companies like Sikorsky are forbidden by law from bribery.
Yep.
There was a European zone consortium that has names that are difficult to pronounce for me, but they're there. They
were
there.
Excuse your French is what you're saying?
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't even French in this case. It looks like it was something else. But at any rate,
umlauts involved, and
it wasn't quite that bad. And the name is in here somewhere if you're interested in it. But there was a consortium of several companies in the Eurozone that was in competition with Sikorsky.
Uh-huh.
The Russians apparently weren't even in competition. This is a very sophisticated set of helicopters, by the way. It's naval helicopters. It's a variant of the Black Hawk, but it has sonar and torpedo launching capabilities and lots of good stuff on it.
Things India really needs.
They do.
Yeah.
Actually, they do, because the Pakistanis have submarines.
Right, and there are a lot of pirates in that area.
Yeah.
All of those are good things to have.
And it's designed to launch from a ship, and basically the Indian Navy is in a build-up mode. Anyway, what's happened here is that one of the members of the consortium out of the European zone has recently been convicted of and fined heavily in India for bribery. They were bribing officials on previous contracts. And as a result, the Indian government said, you guys are out. We're going with Sikorsky because you bribed people earlier. And, you know, in the past, I've heard American executives complain about this, and you know, it's just the way it's the way business is done overseas.
Right. There's bribes.
And this
Americans get arrested for giving a bribe in Somalia.
And this is an example of how that particular policy, over a long period of time, is starting to change the way the game is played out there. The Indians are in the middle, just like the Chinese are, by the way, in the middle of an anti-corruption crackdown. And in the process, the fact that one of the members of the consortium, which was Finicia or something like that, had been convicted of bribery. No, it's Finmecia, S-P-A.
All right.
F-I-N-M-E-C-C-A-N-I-C-A, and then followed by an S-P-A, which probably means it's a Spanish company, S-P-A. I don't know.
Right.
But at any rate,
or
it had been convicted.
A spa. There's a spa involved with the helicopters.
Could be.
Somewhere.
I don't know. The whole issue is that because of their earlier bribery conviction, Sikorsky got a $1 billion deal. Now, the $1 billion deal for the helicopters,
it's an Italian company,
is just the beginning of the process, which, by the way, is not Italy. It's not illegal in Italy or the European zone to bribe officials of foreign governments. But it is in the United States.
SPA is an Italian business entity for it. It's like an LLC or something like that.
It's Italian. Well, that's another really good reason not to. Never mind. But the follow-on contracts for the missiles and the sonar and
the things that go
on the helicopter will virtually, by definition now, go to the United States because the things to hang on that particular helicopter are not made somewhere else.
Hmm. Kind of like buying a Mac. You really have to buy Mac accessories.
You got that. So the issue is that what I'm trying to say is that these little indications, which are going on in many, many, many cases around the world right now, strongly indicate that the United States, by our values and by the health of our economy and by our ability to consistently fulfill contracts, is drawing further ahead of any international competition we have.
Yeah, this is just a side note as an example of another area. Americans are not kidnapped abroad at anywhere near the rate of, say, the French. The French get kidnapped a lot more than Americans do. In fact, when Americans get kidnapped abroad, a lot of times they're let go because they don't have kidnap insurance. And Americans don't pay terrorists. We don't say, here's a ransom, because and the State Department is very proud of the fact that they say, we will not pay ransoms to kidnappers for American citizens, period. We might send the special forces in, but we're not going to pay them money. And the French pay money, and the Spanish pay money, and the Mexicans pay money.
Well, I don't know. We contribute bullets.
We do contribute. We do pay for the bullets.
But they're used.
Yeah.
We recycle lead.
Yeah, lead deposits are being discovered again.
That happened in Yemen a couple of times recently. Unfortunately, it didn't work out for the hostages, but it certainly did not work out well for the kidnappers.
Yeah, there's a series of things that are happening regularly in the way our foreign policy works, and this is something that hasn't been decayed by any president. It's been added to by each president. Doesn't matter if they're Democrat or Republican. It's a representation of American values. We don't pay ransoms. We don't negotiate with terrorists, period. And we don't allow Americans to bribe foreign governments, period.
This Sikorsky deal, one of the reasons I'm making a big deal out of it, is it's an example that you can really begin to understand, because a lot of people will be employed in the United States. Money will be flowing to the United States from India. But India has gone from the 24th, number 24, as an arms purchaser of the United States based on who we sell weapons to dollar-wise, to number one. Last year they purchased $1.9 billion versus weapons systems from the United States. Someone is beating on our window.
Yes.
I suppose we should. I don't know what we would do about that.
Yeah. I'm going to take my headset off.
You're going to take your head off? I want to see. Anyway,
take my head off.
All right. Well, Jake is departing momentarily, so Jeff will be here to take care of you while he finds out who's beating on our window. The this picture is a growing picture, and the reason, and I want to emphasize something here. India is a high growth economy. It doesn't get as much press on this issue as does China, but it is one of those up-and-coming economies that has a tremendous potential to grow into the 21st century. It has historically been an ally of and dependent upon Russia for its military hardware, and it has become the number one export customer for military equipment of the United States. That's one of those watershed issues in history that really, really, really indicate the big picture. We have been in competition with Russia for as long as I've been alive, and Russia is becoming far more bellicose and is becoming far more aggressive. They have decided to reassert themselves in the world, and sometimes Americans, I think, have been justifiably concerned about that. But one of the things that this indicates, one of the key elements, as we look at the news and we realize what's going on in the world, the Russians' arms industry has largely been funded historically by sales outside of the country. In other words, they can afford to run their own weapons systems development and manufacture only because they have sold so much stuff. I mean, if you look at what a jihadist is carrying, it's an AK-47, which is made in Russia.
Right. In fact, there's a piece of news, I'm going to throw that in right in the middle of this. Kalashnikov just made an announcement that they're revamping the new AK. They're going to make it look pretty. They're putting in composite stocks, and they're changing the design of the magazine, and it's this whole new look that they're going for. And it's because they're going out of business. The reason
they have to change something, right?
Right. The reason why they're going out of business is there's about $250 million worth of AK-type items that are waiting to be exported to the United States, but our sanctions are not allowing them. So the AK, which is a design made and sponsored by Kalashnikov as a company, but it is largely government-controlled by oligarchs again. That's just the way Russia runs. And they are seeing a drop in their, and they're pretty close to the lowest amount that they've ever sold. And part of that is because the design of the Kalashnikov is easy to be copied elsewhere in the world. You can make those parts and basically in a blacksmith. They don't have to be all that technically correct. And so hundreds of millions of dollars are waiting out there. The Russians, that's a big chunk of their government economy as well. Oil and arms sales make up over half of the revenue that goes to the government. And their oil prices have dropped by half. And the arms sales have dropped tremendously over the past year. So they're in a world of hurt right now. And Putin just made an announcement that the economy's in trouble and that everybody needs to band together and that that they're probably going to go into recession. Probably. They're already in recession.
They're in recession.
We are probably going to be in recession. It's a good way of being an accurate forecaster is just give forecasts about the background. Is what happened just now.
Forecast the past.
Right. I have a very high degree of accuracy when I forecast the past.
You do?
Sometimes. Sometimes I get it completely wrong, but I will admit my mistakes. Putin doesn't have that weakness.
No, he doesn't make mistakes.
No, he doesn't. He thought he did once when he was wrong.
Right. The only, and by the way, one of the key elements here, and this is a big piece of the picture, is that the price of oil coming down below $70 a barrel is a real shocker to a lot of economies around the world.
Yeah, it's at 65 now.
There have been, I read several forecasts by people who seem to be reasonably well knowledgeable about this issue, who suggests that $60 a barrel is not only probable but almost certain.
Yeah, it's probably going to drop down into the 50s.
And that probably will be the range where it stays. But they were saying that about 70, and they were saying that about 80.
I don't think oil will stay in a range. It's by its nature. It fluctuates.
But the key to that is the decision by OPEC not to cut production. And the reason, by the way, they didn't want to cut production, there's a whole series of reasons. One of which is
a great example of that.
That if the Saudis did their traditional production cut, no one else would accompany it. Matter of fact, some of them would raise their production. But there is a grand conspiracy theory, which has absolutely no basis in fact, I can tell, but it was an interesting conspiracy theory, going about that the United States government convinced Saudi Arabia to block any effort to hold the price of oil up, and that this is a concerted effort by the CIA to lower the price of oil
Yeah, anybody that believes that has missed a lot of the world stage movements over the past 2 years.
Well, I mean,
Saudis have been separating themselves from the way the United States does business because they don't like the way we've handled Syria. They don't like the way we've handled Libya. They don't like the way we're handling the Islamic State.
Right, and I am just simply saying, if the CIA were capable of bringing the price of oil down from 100 to 60 or 120 to 60.
That's like omnipotence.
I'm really proud. Hey, I'm really proud of the CIA.
That's a pretty amazing thing. That's better than George Soros by far.
But it really is one of those things that's hard to imagine how it could be better for the United States. Now, admittedly,
we're selling oil, and we've just become the largest exporter of oil in the world. So bringing the price of oil down would not be a really good idea for the CIA to do to benefit us and not Russia.
The issue is that we're continuing to produce oil, and we can still be profitable. And there's a tremendous amount of oil going to be produced based on the capital already invested. We don't have to have new oil fields at this point. Matter of fact, the key is getting the pipelines to haul the oil around.
Right, yeah.
Or getting the railroad, because the railroads are overloaded. We basically...
And the roads are getting beat up anywhere around oil well, because the trucks that are carrying the oil back and forth are ripping it up.
There have been a lot of discussion about the fact that the new permits issued for drilling in the shale fields is dropping dramatically. Well,
yep.
That may have something to do with the price of oil coming down.
It does. It does.
But I don't think it has much to do with it, because they were falling before the price of oil fell. The issue is that
we're at capacity at this point.
You know, we could drill more holes, but we don't have the capacity to get the oil out of the field from the stuff that was pumped up from the holes.
We're at infrastructure capacity as well as drilling capacity. We can't go faster than what we're doing. Not unless we make a bunch of new stuff, and that costs money, which is why the cost of oil comes in, that we already have the equipment to do the stuff, and we're replacing the parts as we go along. We've just stopped making really new stuff, so we're going to continue to grow the development of oil, but it's not going to be at the same rate.
And if you recall, last week we were talking about the fact that Burlington Northern Santa Fe, BNSF, is facing complaints from the coal industry. Well, not from the coal industry, from the power generating industry.
I heard you say the coal industry.
No.
Just don't think that coal industry.
The power generators, particularly in the Northeast, do not have enough coal on hand to make it through the winter, and BNSF is not hauling a lot of coal. Well, the reason is because they're hauling a phenomenal quantity of oil,
and they don't have room on the trains.
Right, you've only got so much track, and the coal industry is trying to get the energy department to force BNSF to haul more coal so that they can have enough coal to get through the winter, supplying power to people, and that. You know, that's all an interesting controversy. Yeah, and
it's one of those things where energy prices could go up because the oil prices there's so much oil out there.
It's an indicator.
Yeah.
It is an indicator that tells you why new oil drilling would fall, and this is completely separate from any price of oil issue. It's simply that we have reached, as Jake was saying, saturation for getting the oil that comes out of the ground to the refineries.
Yeah, and the refineries are close to full capacity.
So, anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we do have to do some commercials.
We've got good stuff to talk about after the commercials. We're going to talk some more about the world stage. I want to talk about China's economy for a little bit.
Oh, yeah, I do, too. Okay. So, we'll be back. The telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
All right. And we'll be back. Hi. And despite all rumors to the contrary, we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And here we are in the KTEM studios, where time stands still. And you can give us a call at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Here in KTEM, where it has been 4:43 either a.m. or p.m. for weeks now.
Weeks and weeks. This clock.
It's twitching, though.
It is twitching.
But that's all it does. It says the second hand twitches. So time effectively is standing still here at KTEM.
Have you noticed that the second hand is really the third hand?
Yes, I have noticed
that's
that.
That's an interesting phenomenon where the second and the third are the same.
Yeah, well, that is one of those things that is one of the great conundrums of time.
Yeah.
See?
Well, I wanted to talk about China.
China. Which is where they get chinos.
I'm not going to touch that.
Okay. So you better not touch my chinos.
There was a report that came out this week, and the World Bank put a thing out, and they're talking about China's economy just passed up the United States, that it's the number one economy in the world.
Wrong.
Let me explain why.
Explain.
Let me explain, Lucy. There's something called producing price parity. PPP. So when people ask you why China is not so big as the United States, you can just say PPP. And they will go, I don't know what that means.
I'm still waiting for you to explain.
Oh, I wasn't going to. I was just going to act like I knew what an acronym. No, what it means is that they price a bicycle or a candy bar in China, and they compare that, and they say, this is the price that is paid for it in Germany, and here's the price that it's paid for in America, and they equalize it. They say, okay, a Hershey's chocolate bar costs the same as a Hershey's chocolate bar, and therefore China's economy is as big or bigger than the United States. Here's the problem with that.
All because of Hershey's chocolate bars, which are made in the United States.
Right. There's a problem with that, and it's a major problem. There's a lot of major problems, but I'm going to start with a minor one, just for the fun of it.
Okay.
Just because I mentioned a chocolate bar. They don't equalize for import or export. They don't say, what did it cost to get that chocolate bar to China? That's not part of the equation. They just say, all right, it's the same here as there, therefore it must be inexpensive in both places. That means it's the same price. And here's the problem with that. American chocolate, which is one of the big, Switzerland and America are big chocolate people, and you know, they send out these chocolates, and it costs a lot of money to buy that in other places. There are places in the world that don't eat chocolate very much, which is, you know, the old story in World War II where the soldiers carrying the chocolate bar. And that.
Chocolate is cheap in the United States.
It's cheap in the United States. It's not cheap in China.
It's non-cheap in Europe.
And not cheap in Europe, correct.
They tax the heck out of it in Europe.
Russia spends per capita about 30% of a person's income on food just to survive. In the United States, this is just averages, it's 6%. So if you take the price of food and say this, well, we're going to say that's all equal, then that means that 30% of Russians' income is the equivalent of 6% of an American's income. Is percent about 40%. It doesn't work this way.
This is why people generally don't like economists.
Right, because we're going, well, that doesn't make any sense.
No. The economists are putting this together.
Right, and the economists are going, well, it makes sense to me. A chocolate bar is a chocolate bar is a chocolate bar. All right, so next one, and this is the major issue. This is the one that leaves the chocolate bar price parity issue completely out the window, which is bad on a sunny day because it could be melted if it's out the window.
Particularly in the summertime.
Right. China's currency is artificially locked to the dollar, which means that any kind of parity in objects is artificial. If you look at production value of the things that they have and the world trade availability for it, that's the only way you can really price something. You could say that my car is worth the same thing as a person in Germany's car. But when you go to sell it, you're going to find that it's not. And if you say that my bicycle is the same price as somebody in China's bicycle and you go to sell it, you're going to find it's not. It's just not that way. It's not that simple. And when an economy, a government, consciously links their currency to another currency, it distorts it even further. The reality is that China's economy is roughly 25% of the United States economy. And you can see that in quality of living. You can see that in a lot of things. And it's pretty apparent when you go to the world stage, which is the biggest market. There's a stage that sits out there on the world somewhere. Right. I hear people talk. I haven't seen it yet, but there is evidently... Shakespeare said the whole world's a stage. So
right.
Maybe that
and
is the world stage.
We are but players
stage.
On it. It's, right. it's like the Globe Theater. It is a globe.
It is the Globe Theater, yeah.
Right.
So the world stage is where the marketplace values things. And another reason why this distortion is a distortion is if you think about, say, a board that goes in your computer, an electronic board that goes in your computer that is manufactured in China. The price of that board in the United States is the finished product that is actually going into a piece of hardware. The price of that board in China isn't. There is no price on that board because it's an American company that's created that board in China, not for sale in China, but for sale in the United States.
Well, it really boils down to something very simple. If we use dollars, for example.
I do use dollars.
Okay.
I try to use
We use that as a measuring device.
Yeah, I'd use it for
Chinese,
buying things.
Because the Chinese purchase things outside of China, they can't use their local currency because it's not available for that.
Correct.
They use dollars. And if we look at the number of dollars produced by the Chinese economy, we discover it's a heck of a lot less than the number of dollars produced by the United States economy. And
yeah.
Since they have elected to use dollars to purchase things outside of their own country, and
correct.
So do we, their economy is a lot smaller than ours. And the other thing I wanted to talk about, we'll get into this next hour, Lord willing, is that the Chinese economy is potentially fragile.
Yeah, it's more than potentially. I think it's very fragile.
Well, I mean, it is a potential problem at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it is one of those things that if I was going to worry about something, I think I would worry about that at this point. And we've mentioned in the past there were three great experiments went on after the financial collapse really got underway in 2008. The United States chose one methodology. The European zone chose another. And the Chinese chose yet a third. Well, the European zone one apparently has not worked particularly well. The Chinese one seemed initially to have worked exceptionally well, but it appears that it may be about to backfire on them with really unpleasant consequences.
The cattail theory may be about to be mm-hmm. displayed.
And because it was a major bank failure last
week.
We've
got to be,
right.
We got to go. We'll be back next hour, and we'll give you contact information then. So until next hour.
Truth, it's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.